Their names the world knows quite well. Anna Sorokin, the Tinder swindler, Bernie Madoff. But long before their fraud and Ponzi schemes came to light, a man named Alan Rosenberg was perfecting the art of the con. The Canadian septuagenarian spent decades convincing people he was a successful tycoon, scamming banks, art galleries and investors out of their money. His activities in Yorkville, a particularly posh part of Toronto, earned him the nickname the Yorkville Swindler. He's the subject of a documentary called The Talented Mr. Rosenberg. It will screen as part of the Fraud Film Festival in Auckland next week. The director is award-winning Canadian documentary filmmaker Barry Averich, and this film isn't the first real dirty, rotten scoundrel he's turned his lens on. Barry, thank you for being with us.
My absolute pleasure to join you.
I think it's Bernie Madoff, actually, now that I think of it, which seems an appropriate pronunciation in some ways, doesn't it, for one of the biggest and probably most high-profile scams.
Not to worry, I don't think he will sue you.
No, he's got other things on his mind.
Yes, including death, but yes.
This is an area that you love to work in. What is it that will draw you to a character or a story?
Well, I don't think it's just me. I think the world's fascination with swindlers and con men and criminals is running rampant. It's the halcyon days of this kind of storytelling, and you see it on pretty much every platform from Netflix to Amazon to Hulu to Apple. It's everywhere, primarily because I think people get to put themselves in their shoes without having to suffer the consequences of a prison term or humiliation. It's fascinating. And generally, as you saw in the film, people believe they will never fall victim or prey to people like Albert Rosenberg, and yet they do. So it's kind of fun to watch this Catch Me If You Can story and see if you would fall prey.
And you have an unreliable narrator, let's face it, right at the outset. And a lot of it is also what to believe and what not to believe, coming from your source and those around your source.
I think that's what makes this film distinctive compared to the other con films that are out there, is that our subject actually sat down to be interviewed versus stories about, in this particular case, Mr. Rosenberg elected to sit down and do very long interviews and tell his side of the story. People wonder what motivated him, whether it's, you know, a narcissistic, manipulative way to tell his story and shape it versus the journalists that have covered him. I'm not sure, but he is compelling.
You haven't reached a conclusion on that. What first brought him to your attention?
I read a story in a magazine called Toronto Life, a classic city magazine, not unlike New Yorker magazine or Vanity Fair, that liked covering almost these salacious stories, city stories. And I was fascinated by the story, wonderfully written by Courtney Shea, a Canadian journalist. And I just kept thinking about it. And when you make documentaries, and I've made quite a few, you're constantly have these post-its on your brain of story ideas, and Albert Rosenberg would not go away. And then I would continue to see him around various streets in Toronto. And that's when I decided to reach out to him and say, how would you like to tell your side of the story? Surprisingly, he agreed. We went for lunch, left my wallet and watch in the glove compartment, my car, and we had lunch and set out to plan.
What was your first impression?
Extraordinarily charming. One could understand why anyone could potentially fall victim. He's well-dressed in cashmere sweaters and Valentino boots, as one would see in the film. And he is tanned. He knows a little bit of just about everything to be dangerous, as they say, whether you bring up art or architecture, medicine, politics, he has an opinion. And so he comes across as very sophisticated and well-educated.
Part of his motive perhaps revealed with his dislike of the journalist who'd covered him, quote unquote, she was vicious. She wanted me to make me look like I was a kind of devil. Mm. Is he wanting to rewrite his story?
Oh, for sure. I think any great I'm not a psychiatrist and I'm not a psychologist, but there's no question Albert Allen Rosenberg was hoping to shape the story and as he says at the outset of the film, try to prove to those people that see it that he's not such a bad guy. The challenge here ultimately was the balance of how not to make the film comical, even though Albert can come across as a comical character, humorous in his answers and his in the way he positions himself, and yet understand the severity of his crimes. And so I had to find that balance in the storytelling.
And indeed, in the way the narrative devices are employed, the opening sequence, a tad Pink Panther-esque, the music very Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. You are telling a story, but as you say, you as a director need to keep control, I guess, of the tone and the tenor while also engaging. And is that a critical part of the craft of documentary making in particular, and particularly challenging with a character like this?
It's a brilliant question. Thank you. I think the craft of documentary filmmaking is to begin with to be entertaining. You want to be factual. You want to be entertaining. You want to be commercial. I'm not the right filmmaker to make a film on an oil spill. They should be made. I'm just not that person. I think in the films that I make, I want them to be extraordinarily accessible, and I want as many people to possibly see the film as possible, my films. When you then add the ingredient of Albert Rosenberg, you become much like a lion tamer or P.T. Barnum in trying to control an act. When we were filming Albert, my co-producer on the film, Caitlin Chetty, would was constantly holding up a pad. Making notes of his lies and keeping score, and because just things that he was saying were so inconceivable. I don't think he planned on me fact-checking him. I thought he thinks that, we would just create a glossy magazine spread of his life and how he was misunderstood. And yes, he would always admit to his crimes. However, he was really a nice guy, but certainly keeping check of what he was saying and what was true and wasn't was critical. That's why we, it was a great coup for us to find his daughter, his estranged, one of his estranged daughters, and his and what ended up being his second wife in Switzerland, and getting her to respond to our questions, to really paint the picture of who Albert Rosenberg is.
Let's talk about that challenge of fact-checking, because you must feel like you've gone into a maze at times, and I'm sure you've got a team around you, but just give us an indication of the versions of events that would be presented and then how you would check. Even the most basic things, like where he is born, what age he is.
Very complicated to cut that tree open and count the rings. The reality is that there is no passport or birth certificate for Albert Rosenberg. So if he claimed he was born in Montreal, we did as best we can to find some kind of records, of which we did. His we were able to locate his. Interestingly enough, his found out that his father. His birth father, who his birth mother divorced, remarried in Montreal. So we were able to fact check some of that. Schools that he claimed that he went to that did not have any record of his schooling or his graduation. Even suggesting it was tricky. His three daughters, their ages, which made no sense mathematically or scholastically at times. And he had, at one point, when he knew I was really pushing him and challenging him before he sort of said, I don't want to do this anymore, he had sent us a letter, which is in the film, signed by his three daughters, saying, our dad's a great guy. He's made mistakes, but we truly love him and support him. Well, he wrote the letter. The daughter, one of the daughter's names was spelt incorrectly, his own daughter's name, Penelope, spelt incorrectly, and the signatures were all very similar. So some fact checking was and errors that he made were easily detected. Others were tricky. We were constantly finding new things. We thought that his wife, the mother of his children that had took off to in self-exile to Switzerland, was his first wife, and then found through archives that he had been married briefly to another woman in Toronto before that marriage was nullified. So it was not easy, but we had a great team constantly finding facts on him.
You mentioned the breakthroughs, which is to get family members to speak and one of the daughters to participate in the
Huge.
documentary. What does she know or what does she believe about her father? And is she on the same magical mystery tour to some extent that you are?
Well, it's funny, when I approached him, she was, very skeptical. And what she said to me was, finally, which I found fascinating, she said, I will do this primarily as a anthropological experiment. And okay, that's interesting. That's the first I've heard in being someone that's interviewed everybody from Mick Jagger to Tony Bennett, that, all right, that's interesting. She did not want to be seen on camera. She was still nervous of him. I think she's, as you see in the film, there's a point where she tries some kind of a rapprochement with her father, a reunion with him in Toronto, and it does not go well. I think, like any child, it's still your father. You want to believe and hope that there's some kind of redemption of some sort, and you hope. But it never happens. And, as difficult as he was as a father to her, as she explains, of being, abused mentally by him and constant lying, she does want to try to reunite with him. And but yet she was very candid with me in all of the emails and certainly on camera about what was true and what wasn't. She said there are no diplomas. There were no diplomas. She never saw anything and never knew anything about his education. They lived a very fancy life, which is, and he admits that on film. He said he was, addicted to money and status and pedigree, and that's what he feels his downfall is. Maybe, but ultimately, he is a serial con artist.
Is there a moment where you felt like you got some insight? And when you're talking to him about his parents, I'll give you a clue for what I'm angling for, about his mother and father, do you think that side of what he's telling you may have some truth, provide some insight?
At times, I mean, there's glimmers of insight into him. You never feel sorry for him. You understand, you don't understand what propels him, but you do. Again, you have to separate the brilliant con artistry of him versus the human being. I think the best insight that I got to him, and sort of this great moment that I got from him, is when I said to him, and even as you introduced him as Alan Rosenberg, and there's evidence of him calling himself Alan and Albert, and there's times where Albert Alan, and I said to him, well, which is it? And he said, well, when I do things legally, it's Albert. And I was like, what? All right, so when you're referring to yourself as Alan, that's when you're do things that are illegal. He just can't keep any story straight, which is a classic con artist. When you tell so many lies, how do you keep them together? And this was a man who just sort of kept going and going. As recent as Christmas in 2022, a friend told me a story that that a real estate agent in their office in Toronto had come into the office very excited that she thought she had sold a luxury penthouse to someone. And they said, oh, what's the name? Who's going to buy it? And she said, oh, a man named Albert Rosenberg. And they went, oh God,
There you go.
he's not going to buy it.
Barry Averich is our guest. We are talking about his documentary, The Talented Mr. Rosenberg. It will screen as part of the Fraud Film Festival, being screened in Auckland next week. He's a director and the award-winning Canadian documentary filmmaker. 21 past 10 it is on 9 to noon. Let's talk about his methods and the number and variants of different frauds. Could you outline some that particularly caught your attention?
It's endless, and it didn't matter. I mean, some of them were, conning a starting a new a business investors fund, and based on a new software, medical software in a hospital. It could have been a new investing or stock market scheme of a new fund. It was also crazy things like conning art galleries all over the world to oddly enough, send, you know, priceless pieces of art on consignment to his new offices because he, you know, he looked good. And here's his address is going to be this fancy high rise in whatever city, to, you know, conning restaurateurs who lost their restaurants because they would put $100,000 or $200,000 into an investment. He conned a luxury Italian furniture store in sending him furniture for his new offices that weren't even built, to conning an interior design firm to designing his offices and spending, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on plans and things like that. It really didn't matter. And that's what we know about. We know that, you know, he would appear as a tennis pro, a pilot, an art collector, a businessman, an author, a doctor. It really didn't matter. It was a mix of Catch Me If You Can meets Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And again, when you talk to Albert, there is almost in his affectation, this almost lovable is the wrong word, but this very approachable, you know, he doesn't come across too much as a snob, although he is. But, you know, according to his ex-wives, he has a, you know, a horrific temper, which I saw a little of.
This is another important part in the documentary, and you mentioned earlier, and you describe in the film how he got annoyed with you pushing back against his inaccuracies, mm-hmm. and then he pulled out. But then his third ex-wife agrees to talk to you, and her story a little different. She went to police because of his abuse. What did this clarify for you? What did this change for you about your analysis of him?
That you know, these cons were not necessarily on super wealthy people or people that can afford to lose the money or got hurt financially in a certain level, that his cons can reach a level of severity that destroys lives. In this particular case, his third wife, you know, she lost a home because he convinced her to sell the home and put the money in what was somewhat like a joint account. He convinced her to give up her job. He isolated her from her friends. He became mentally and at one point physically abusive of her. And she will never be the same because she was humiliated. And you know, you just can't survive. I saw a very broken person. And it was tragic to see that he can go to that. Again, it's one thing to be a pickpocket. It's another to sort of walk through a fancy store and grab a watch or a coat or convince a wealthy person or a bank to invest money into a fraudulent scheme. These people have insurance quite often. In this particular case with this woman and others, they don't have insurance and it was their life savings. So you saw a side of a man that, you know, was not a comical con artist, not a lovable guy, but a man that had the capability for true evil.
This is interesting. This brings us to some of your other work or work that you were working on. And I think at one stage you had a production in the works that would have focused on Jeffrey Epstein, but that yes. may have been put to one side after his suicide. And you went on to produce The Reckoning, which was about Harvey Weinstein. This is interesting because you had done earlier work on Weinstein, and one of the extraordinary things about him, not just his power in Hollywood, but how his crimes were tolerated, covered up, not talked about over all Yep. those decades of his extraordinary influence across Hollywood and filmmaking. Are there parallels in the psyche of some of these people whose stories interest you?
100%. I mean, I'm always interested in the Shakespearean trajectory of a character, whether it be Harvey, who had it all, and, you know, had he not had this, and it's a big if, but had he not had this depravity, he would probably be remembered as, you know, one of the great film producers of all time. Jeffrey Epstein, who was successful in business, but I'm sure that'll be an autopsy will be done on his business career of what was real and what wasn't. But he certainly made a lot of money, and that should have been enough. And And, you know, people like that who take such extraordinary risks, even though they've had it all, those that, like Icarus, fly too close to the sun for some need of heat, and then, you know, their wings melt. So there are parallels in Albert and Harvey and Madoff and Epstein. My Epstein project was not that I didn't put it aside because he had committed suicide. When I was making the film, he had not even been arrested the second time. He was not even a headline. The fact was that no one wanted the film because no one had heard of him, even though I was potentially going to expose him to the world long before he was arrested. I'm talking 5 years before anyone knew who he was, and there wasn't a streamer or network that would take it because they'd never heard of him.
Barry, one other point just to finish. What an interesting arc your creative life has taken from very young days when you were very entrepreneurial at an early age with the Rent-A-Fan Club, which I absolutely loved. I think that could completely be revived circa 2023, right? Although social media perhaps provides it for us instead. But if you go back to those early influences, what do you point to? What were some of the sort of critical stages of your career? And did a lot of it start really from childhood and your parents' influence?
It did. You know, my father always took me to movies, and he'd say, "Watch the audience, not the movie." He was in sales, and he understood, didn't understand the film business, but he understood what an audience reacted to, whether he was selling something or not, and fascinated by human behavior. And at the same time, they knew they had a character in the house, and so it would be get on the up on the table and tell stories from comedy records I had heard and mimicked, to understanding early on that there was something in the documentary art form that allowed me a control of the story and whatever story I wanted to tell, assuming somebody would buy it. But I wasn't necessarily beholden to a studio when it came to casting or a script. These were stories that I could tell. And I loved doing that from day one.
Thank you. Barry Averich, who is a documentary filmmaker and director of this latest work, The Talented Mr. Rosenberg, a play, of course, there on The Talented Mr. Ripley, and there are features of that character in this doco as well. It is screening at the Fraud Film Festival, intriguingly named, which is happening next week in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. And you can get details of that by going to our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9toNoon. There is a link there through to the program. It is an International Fraud Film Festival.